You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
Bird migration is one of the great wonders of the natural world. Every year, millions of birds fly huge distances across oceans and continents, battling storms and predators to reach wintering grounds that many of them have never even been to before. The mysteries of how they do that are just starting to be unraveled. But at the same time as our knowledge of bird migration grows, the birds themselves are facing more and more stresses on those journeys, primarily caused by human impact on the landscape. Some biologists, in fact, argue that we will see the end of many of these incredible journeys in our lifetimes if we don't take strong steps to protect the resources birds need along the way. Scott Wiedensahl is the author of Living on the Wind, Across the Hemisphere with Migratory Birds. I spoke with Scott Wiedensahl earlier this week, and I began by asking him, what percentage of birds migrate?
Well, out of the roughly 750 or 800 species of birds that we have in North America, about 500 of those species are migratory. Now, you know, the word migratory covers an awful lot of behavior. It covers the species that go, you know, thousands and thousands of miles, that go from one hemisphere to the next. It also covers species that may only move a matter of a few hundred miles, in some cases only a few dozen miles. I mean, there are some species that migrate regularly, but they don't do it across great distances. They do it altitudinally, going from high elevation in the summertime to low elevation in the winter, or even some like blue grouse in the western mountains, which go from low elevations in the summertime to high elevations in the winter. They actually move up, you know, well up into the snow line toward timberline.
So it's not just like, I guess here in Canada, then we would tend to think, and I guess where you are too, we'd think of migration as being birds flying south, but it's way more complex than that then.
Absolutely. I mean, like, for example, I live in eastern Pennsylvania, and we used to love in the wintertime when evening grosbeaks would show up at our feeder. Well, those were not birds coming down out of the eastern provinces of Canada. Many of those were birds that were coming from western Canada and coming southeast across the Great Plains to winter in the eastern United States and then heading back again. You see the same thing with, for example, the ducks known as redhead. There's a lot of east-west migration there.
Do birds principally migrate to get away from the cold?
If you ask the average person on the street, I'm sure that's what they would tell you. But actually, birds can tolerate the absolute worst weather that this planet can throw at them. It's not the cold per se that drives bird migration. It's primarily food. But most of the groups of birds that are most highly migratory are the ones that depend on food resources or seasonally available habitat. Like, for example, you know, you think about the literally hundreds of millions of insect-eating birds that flood into the boreal forests of Canada every year. There is food available for those birds in the wintertime. There are dormant insects and spider egg masses and things like that, which is why chickadees and kinglets and many other insect-eating birds are able to survive there in the wintertime. There just isn't enough food for all of those literally billions of insect-eating birds. So in wintertime, they have to head back south again. You know, you think about waterfowl, for example, the habitats that they depend on, you know, open water, disappears in the wintertime and are not able to escape predators.
How do birds actually know where to go when they migrate?
Most people have an image of, you know, sort of the wise old elder of the flock imparting the wisdom of the ages to the young bird, you know, teaching them the route, teaching them the stopover sites, you know, oh, don't go down on that marsh, son, because there's lots of hunters down there. The fact of the matter is that with the exception of a handful of groups of birds, like waterfowl and cranes, where there is a lot of sort of generational learning, you know, from, you know, younger birds flying with older birds and learning specific routes. But every other bird practically comes out of the egg with this genetically coded set of instructions that tells them to fly in a certain direction at a certain time of the year for a certain length of time. You know, you can have a shorebird like an American gold plover that has never been more than a quarter of a mile from its nest. Its parents abandoned it as soon as it was old enough to fly. It's heading south on a migration that's going to take it all the way to, you know, to Uruguay or to Argentina, and is traveling with other golden plovers of its own age, none of whom have been, you know, more than a quarter mile from their nest. and they're driven on this migration. They're driven to take the migration by instinct. You know, it's triggered by the changing ratio of daylight and darkness. In order to get to where they're going, they're instinctively looking at a whole host of environmental cues, many of which, you know, we're blind, deaf, and dumb to. You know, these birds, most birds, regardless of whether they're normally active by day or night, most birds migrate after dark, and the night sky is one of the most important orientation cues for them. They're looking up at the stars, not at the pattern of the stars, but at the rotation of the stars around Polaris. That's the key that gives them the cardinal points. But if it's a cloudy night and they can't see the stars, well, then they will use the Earth's magnetic field. They're able to see bands of polarized light across the sky in daytime, which isn't visible to us. They can hear extremely low-frequency sound waves, which travel halfway around the world. Some birds can smell their way back home. A lot of the seabirds have an extraordinarily sharp sense of smell. So, I mean, these birds are using a whole host of cues to move them across the landscape, often to a place, as I said, that they've never been before, and to which they're only being led by, you know, these genetically coded instructions in their brain.
What do birds need along the way on those tremendously long journeys that they take in order to complete their migration successfully?
Well, the only way that these, particularly these long-distance migrants, can get from point A to point B is by having sufficient fat stores. Fat is the fuel that makes birds go. They only lay it on usually during migration season. A non-migrating species, a resident species like a screech owl or a song sparrow, will lay on very little fat during its lifetime. A warbler, on the other hand, that has to fly from, say, the coast of Maine or Nova Scotia across the western Atlantic Ocean on a 90-hour nonstop flight to the northern coast of South America may almost double its weight, lay on, you know, 5 or 6 grams of fat. If they don't have enough food, obviously, if they can't lay on that fat, and this is the real issue, I think, for migrating birds today. They have to have sufficient stopover sites along the way where they can rest and refuel. We used to think that if you wanted to protect birds, you needed to protect the places where they nested. And then we got a little more sophisticated, and we realized we also have to protect the places that they're going to on their non-breeding grounds, whether it's in the tropics or here in the temperate zone. But now, I think ornithologists and conservationists recognize you have to protect all those little convenience stores along the way. And it may be as simple as a scruffy little urban park in the middle of an otherwise, you know, concrete jungle. And so if you don't have a network of you know, high-quality habitat islands scattered across the landscape for them, you know, they may find themselves in trouble.
People might say that birds have been migrating for thousands of years and in a constantly changing climate, and that they will be able to adapt to the most recent changes that are being thrown at them by human activity along their routes. Is this a reasonable kind of a way to look at the issue, in your view?
I don't really think that it is. I mean, for one thing, it overlooks the fact that every time we add another stress to this system, these are cumulative stresses. And migration, we know, is in itself inherently difficult and inherently dangerous for a bird. I mean, look at something like a black pole warbler that, you know, nests in the spruce forests of Manitoba. That bird will migrate east across all of Canada, will stage up along the northeastern coast, make, as I said, a 90-hour nonstop trip to the coast of South America, fly down deep into the jungles of the Amazon, come back up north in the spring through the center of the continent. We'll make this probably a 13,000-mile round trip every year across storms and, you know, battling exhaustion and predators. And then you add on top of that the loss of habitat here, the loss of habitat in the wintering ground. These are birds, many of which make a nonstop 600-mile flight across the Gulf of Mexico. And they don't have access, you know, to Doppler radar and the weather channel. And so they don't know when they set off from the Yucatan Peninsula on this 24-hour flight whether they're going to run into a storm halfway across. And if they do, and they use up almost all of their energy reserves in making that crossing, when they make landfall along the Gulf Coast, they need food immediately. I mean, I have seen birds, you know, literally drop out of the sky 100 yards short of their destination along the Gulf Coast. The ones that make it to shore have to have high quality food, and in fact, what they're finding increasingly along the U.S. Gulf Coast are condominiums and high rises and gambling casinos. I mean, anything but food. And these are the birds, you know, this is one of the most important weak links in this whole hemispheric migration chain, because virtually all of the birds that come out of the tropics and breed across the eastern two-thirds of North America, in Canada and the U.S. both, pass through that Gulf region from, say, western Florida to eastern Texas, which is one of the most rapidly developing parts of the United States. And without that food, without those stopover sites, we know for a fact that these birds are not able to gain enough weight to come back to their breeding ground. If you look at the number of birds that cross the Gulf of Mexico every year, the flocks are so big that you can see them on weather radar. And those weather radar images have been archived all the way back to the 1950s. You can see that the number of birds crossing the Gulf has decreased by at least 50%. It's clear that these birds are in trouble, and it's also clear that the loss of habitat, the loss of migration, is one of the most important things driving that decline.
Now, the biologist J.P. Myers, that you quote at the end of your book, says that we face the end of migrations in our lifetime. Would you agree with that?
Some of them, certainly. I mean, we're seeing this happen right now. There's a marvelous bird called the red knot. And these birds have one of the longest migrations of any land bird in the Western Hemisphere. They breed in the Arctic archipelagos of Canada. They winter at the southern tip of South America in Patagonia, Tierra del Fuego. It's about an 18,000-mile-a-year trip. And they are utterly dependent on their spring migration north on the marine resources of the Delaware Bay in New Jersey and Delaware. They arrive starting in early May, just right around then, as horseshoe crabs in previous years by the millions would come up out of the deep waters of the bay and lay their eggs. And the birds were able to arrive there, many of them having just made a 4,000 or 5,000-mile nonstop flight from Brazil. They would arrive, they would feed voraciously for about 2 weeks, double their weight, and then make another 2,500-mile nonstop flight into the Canadian Arctic to breed. And they have to arrive with enough fat reserves because they're arriving at a time when the Arctic is still locked in snow and ice. They have to set up their territory, find a mate, build a nest, start to lay eggs, and doing all of this on stored fat. Well, there's a commercial fishery in the last 15 years has arisen in the Delaware Bay for horseshoe crabs, and they have basically strip mined so many horseshoe crabs out of the Delaware Bay that the number of eggs available for these birds has declined by more than 90%. And the birds are not getting enough to eat. They're not breeding successfully. The population is in free fall. It's dropped from roughly about 100,000 red knots in the late 1980s to probably, well, certainly well fewer than 17,000 now. In fact, it may be as little as half of that based on last winter's surveys. And this is a very clear case of how human activity is driving the imminent collapse of one of the most dramatic bird migrations in the Western Hemisphere.
And I was speaking there with Scott Wiedensahl, and I spoke with him earlier this week. He's the author of a wonderful book, Living on the Wind, Around the Hemisphere with Migratory Birds.
You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.